accession number 11939.
Rule 7.
Mr. J. L. Williams, Reel 7. You arrived at Frenny Seasat, Mr. Williams. How were you billeted in this village?
Well, we were billeted in houses, which appeared to have been emptied for us. We had just a normal sort of palliasses and blankets and so on, unfurnished. And that's all there was to it. Quite comfortable, no complaints, under a roof. And it was January, remember, but it was reasonable. In fact, I don't think we had any snow, if I remember rightly. And it was a small town. We had no trouble at all with the people. The people were extremely friendly, particularly some of the tradespeople who sold food and coffee and that sort of thing, you know. And when we were across there, we weren't allowed to draw our full pay. I just remember what the rate was, the exchange rate, but it must have been well in our favour. But I do remember this, that I could go down on an evening, augmenting our normal rations, we didn't have compo ration in those days, we had the usual sort of army, you know, but I could go down in an evening and get a chunk of bread and Normandy butter, a fried egg and chips, and a coffee for something in the region of eightpence, old money. And that was very, very cheap, all good quality and all well conducted. There never was any trouble in the town when we were there. You could go to an estaminet just to drink. And there was a preference on the part of the troops. Strange enough, they were not wine drinkers. There were the two sorts of beer, beer brune and beer blonde, light beer and dark beer and light beer. And the troops still stuck on that. Mostly the dark beer. I should tell you, in those days, before the lager sort of situation, it was almost slightly effeminate to drink light ale or lager. You had to drink bitter beer and that sort of thing, you know. I actually had a little bit of wine, but wine was a foreign thing to us in those days, extremely foreign. When I see Marks and Spencer's and all the retail places full of various wines, it makes me laugh sometimes when I think of the days when wine was something rather strange that the French. And if they did essay into any of the local stuff, it was the spirits, you know. We tried at Calvados, you know, which is very strong. There was a little bit cider drinking, but in the main, everybody stuck just to beer. And as I say, we got on well with the people. The French kids, sometimes you let the kids sing, Ici France, allez en Angleterre, as though somebody had told them that. Almost like a little chant now and then. But it was all, it should be good nature because we say, Ali, and the kids used to run away laughing, you know.
Did they invite you into their home?
No, I was never invited into a home. To say, the only thing was I was semi-invited. I found this widow who was running a small cafe, who was making a mess of frying earth sur the plat, you know, fried eggs. And I went in and showed her how to fry an egg. And so I was sometimes called into her kitchen and sat down and had a cup of coffee and a chat with her, you know. I went in principally because I was still practicing my schoolboy French and becoming slightly better at it, you know. And she became slightly avaricious.
Did you have any trouble from drunkenness with the population, particularly troops and the population, I should say?
I wasn't aware of any in that small Normandy town. The only deleterious thing which I noticed was children being children. They were allowed to hang around sentry goes and headquarters and that sort of thing. And a lot of the French children were interlarding their French with that popular English swear word which begins with F. And which I was rather sorry to hear because I once heard one young French boy used that language at his mother. It was one of those things. Kids are kids the world over, you know. But really, there wasn't any trouble. And you see, that it was for two reasons. First of all, reasonably disciplined, a lot. And if they made a mess of things, somebody'd write home and tell their, you know, family. And the other thing was, weren't allowed, as I believe I've mentioned, we weren't allowed to draw a whole amount of pay. As a sergeant, I was allowed to draw about £1 a week. This could be increased by application to your officer if you wanted to buy something particularly more expensive. But quite frankly, we didn't, because we were amazingly surprised at the cheapness of everything. And we very rarely exceeded the £1. And of course, we were incurring a nice little credit, you know.
How did the French food outside of the unit, in a sense, compare with your army food? Did you find an enormous difference?
Well, it was home cooking, most of it, you know, even though it wasn't a restaurant. And I suppose we were living a healthy life and we were rather hungry. And the French bread and the fresh butter and the eggs and things like that, and the coffee was something new. I mean, normally we drank tea in the army and so on. And we had a lot of coffee, which was rather nice. And in general, it was very pleasant. And of course, no signs of any rationing. Living in that agricultural area, when I look back now, they mustn't have known there was a war on. The blackout was very, very non-existent.
Had the army food fallen off? Had it fallen away
anyway? Our army food was quite good. Obviously, our commissary was operating quite well, and they were bringing all the things over, you know. We had army bread and stews and potatoes and cooked meals and so on, quite up to the standard of what we were having in England. But it was just the bread was nice and the good butter was nice and plenty of it, as much as you could get, you could spend. But you imagine, with 240 pence a week and a supper costing 8 pence, it was pint went a long way. And I think it was about tuppence or so for a pint of Pierre Brun. You know, it was fairyland as far as we were concerned, you know.
What was the relationship between the soldiers and the females in the area?
Well, there were one or two associations, naturally, wherever you go. I think it was one place. In Frenny, there wasn't any sort of broth or any of that nature, but one of the nearest towns. But some in the region of Lamars or somewhere like that, which was the sort of gay city life, which very few people attended. There were one or two associations with French girls. This widow I was telling about, who grew slightly amorous and with whom I fended off, she subsequently got embroiled with one of our young gentlemen. I think she was just a lonely female, and a lot of males, exotic males, coming into the area, and that was it. I mean, but I didn't hear of any recriminations and so on. We didn't have much to say with the French people themselves, our contemporaries and so on, you know, spoke to some of the older people, and in the estaminets, were pretty well given over to the British, you know. There must have been other drinking places where the French went in and had their drink and so on. But it was a pretty well British existence in a foreign town, you know. And no problems.
You said that you were sleeping in empty houses on palliasses. What was the hygiene situation, the sanitary situation?
Oh, well, it was quite good. I mean, we had plenty of water to get washed in, you know. And I think it was once a week, or perhaps slightly longer, when we could get to a ablutions or a bath or that sort of setup. But no complaints. We kept reasonably clean and tidy, and, you know. I don't think there were any cases of things like scurvy or anything like that, or what to call it, that disease which get from, not scurvy, that thing you get from uncleanliness and sleeping on straw and that sort of thing. We didn't.
Typhus.
No, it wasn't typhus. No, there's an itch which people got sometimes. A sort of mite sometimes got into the body. But we didn't come across anything like that. It's rather funny because, I mean, fresh blood's always attractive to the local insects wherever you go, but it seemed to be quite all right. Remember, it was the middle of winter as well.
What standard of dress and discipline was expected of you now that you were abroad, particularly in comparison with what it had been in England in peacetime? Was there any changes?
Well, of course, if anything, there was a slight drop-off because, remember, right up to October, November, we'd still been polishing our brass buttons and wearing a service dress. And we got into this battle dress, which had no buttons to clean and so on. We had our gaiters had to be blancoed and our boots polished. But discipline's a strange thing. We weren't the smart, button-shining people we'd been just a month or two before, but we certainly... We still knew how to march and sort of conduct ourselves in a proper fashion. I don't think there was any fall away in discipline, but certainly the dress, even to our eyes, was a little bit less glamorous than it was when we were polishing buttons and we had DLI on our...
you still paraded at the start of the day for your meals and...
Yes, oh yes, 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 fallen in, paraded and that sort of thing, yes. And there was always a sick parade, you know, unnecessary, and inspections, kit inspections by the officers. The officers inspected the meals, of course.
Being in France, and obviously with the war looming, were you given any kind of talks or lectures about what to expect and what was to come?
No. No, we were... like a bunch of Boy Scouts on holiday. When I look back, I think we were all basically conscious of the fact that we weren't there just for fun. But we had no indication of anything that we could expect, you know. I don't think at that stage I'd ever seen a tank, British or German or French. The French were, few French that were there on leave and so on, were still dressed in the old blue uniform and the long greatcoat of the quality of the 1418 war, you know. No, it was a blissful ignorance.
Have there been any changes in your offices since moving from England?
No, not really. Not as far as we were concerned. We still had Captain Wood as our colonel, as our company commander, and we still had the junior officers as
Colonel Simpson was still in command.
Colonel Simpson was still in command, oh yes, yes. And, no, there were...
What did you feel about their leadership qualities? Were you quite happy with them?
Well, it would be... We'd been taught to obey them, stand to attention, and so on. And if we thought about it, we just thought, well, they're officers. Let's put it this way. I, as a sergeant, knew that I had to lead a certain number of men, was responsible. My conduct would be, they would take my conduct as an example and that sort of thing. And we automatically assumed that the officers would do the same. But we had no chance to check on things, except there was this one officer who I always thought as a sergeant was too familiar with the men, you know. Slapping him on the back and asking him, had they enjoyed their visit to the brothel and things of that nature, you know. And I don't know whether my spirit was a bit puritanical, but I thought that he should joke with them and but not get onto the stage of sort of, hello, old boy.
Is this the chap that ultimately left you?
Yes,
that you mentioned earlier.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes, yes.
What were your relationships with your own men in your own platoon?
Well. They were all lads from our village of Chopwell, you know. I knew them quite well. And everything. I never had any trouble at all. You go, say, come on. Some of them used to say, it's funny here, isn't it, Sarge? You know, things like that. I'd say, well, it's a foreign country, and there are allies, and this, that, and the other. But in the main, there was no sort of... Later in the war, I found with young soldiers and so on, they were rather. It was sad to see them how much they relied upon you, you know. But these were a lot. Didn't we were still territorial, you know. It's difficult to, for a layman to understand, but we knew each other, and we'd accepted our position. If you were a sergeant, outside your uniform when you were at home, you would be on Christian name terms, but you were always sergeant or corporal. You know, those are the people you'd... Their parents knew your parents and that sort of thing. You were still there. They accepted the sort of situation. And so there was nothing really was wrong at that stage.
In the time that you were with Frenny, had the unit go down to any training of any kind?
No, we used to do marches. And we used to do a little bit of night marching, you know. But nothing more than the Territorial Army camp training, you know. We didn't do anything particularly.
And was this still a light infantry pace?
Oh, yes, almost at light infantry pace. And with light infantry drill, you know what I mean? Carrying our rifles at the trail and saluting from the shoulder and that sort of thing, across the chest and that sort of thing. And it was...
You weren't digging trenches? Or
no, we weren't doing anything at that stage, literally.
How long were you at Frenny?
Well, I'm just trying to work, but I think it couldn't have been much above a month. We seem to be... When I look back now, I'm not quite well to that, but we... seemed to be about a month there, and then a month in this place near Amiens. Then we moved a little bit over Vimy Ridge and into this place, and we're there in March. And then we were up in Lille and then back again, you know. We seemed to be spending about a month or 6 weeks at each place, you know, as we progressed.
And other than the estaminets and drinking and eating, what other leisure activities were there for you?
There were one or two concerts. But very often produced by our local, our own people, you know. And there was a big concert at Le Mans, but we didn't bother going there, you know. It was a long way away there, you know. But in the main, it was... we used to have sing songs and things like that, you know.
Had you got any sport off the ground?
Not in general at that stage, not in general. A little bit later on, we did. We were playing football, so, but not at that stage. We were sort of just sort of bedding into a foreign country, you know, and regrettably not doing an awful lot of training. I hope the French were impressed with us. And as far as warhead was concerned, we weren't particularly impressed by the French in that respect, but they were kind enough people. It was a small place.
And, did you get any opportunity to judge their comments and their reactions towards the war, what might happen?
No. I remember talking to a couple of old men once and so on, and they were calling, referring to the Boche. And they were obviously, although I hadn't questioned upon, they were obviously soldiers of the 1418 war, you know. So referring to Germany as the Boche. And they were saying something to the effect that... hope everything turns out better than it did in the last war, you know. That was about it, you know.
Did they ever mention the Maginot Line at all?
No. Even we didn't mention the Maginot Line because that was a purely French operation, you know.
So you must have moved from Frenay then round February, late February.
Yeah, about February, yes.
And where did you go from there?
I went from there to a place called Ferrières-sur-Somme. It was just a few miles on the west side of Amiens, right out in the country. And we were in a sort of a parish hall there, you know, where we were billeted. And again, there was nothing. We did a bit of marching around this here and there. But I found myself talking a little bit more to the locals because there, you know. I remember one old man pointing to a sort of gully ravine down there and telling me, he said, we killed, in French of course, we killed the German Uhlan with sickles down there. And I said, good Lord, the Germans would be, once they discovered they'd lost one of their men, they would be after you all. They didn't worry at all. I said, because I believe in 1914 or 1915 the Germans were rather oppressive. Oh no, mon sergeant, he said, this was in 1870. It
And the conditions in which you lived in this place, what were they like?
Approximately the same, except we were well out in the country. We were living in a village hall, you know. We were not in civilian billets at all. I mention that because in the next station, I was billeted literally with some French people. Not everybody was, but I'd rather think that A, because I was a sergeant, B, because I could speak a bit of French. I had a bit of...
There'd be no deterioration in the supply situation?
None at all. Oh, no, we didn't know. Literally, we didn't know war was on. And there was a little bit more blackout among this village and so on, you know. Whether they had any lights in peacetime or not, I don't know, but it seemed to be darker there. It was the rolling hills just behind Amiens, you know, and it was a very quiet rural area.
Were there any indications in this place that the war was reaching them, you might say,
No. A lot of these country people, they seem to have their cows and their chickens and their bread and so on, and they seem to be quite... and an ample supply of beer and so on. We found at Amiens there was a tendency to have more beer and less wine, strange enough. A lot of French are supposed to drink wine. They were getting more Belgian or German or British in their drinking, you know. But it was we were just there a short while. Had a couple of trips once into Amiens to get some supplies, or we were the quartermasters or something, you know, but that was my soul trip into a big city. And after leaving Southampton, I was in the small town of Fresnay, and then we were in the small village of Ferrier. But Amiens was a big city then, when I eventually went there, you know.
And were there any problems between the French and the troops in this place?
None at all. The women and girls were then, they were real peasants, you know. A sort of cloth around their head, big boots, black stockings, thick skirts, and speaking in a strong sort of French dialect that you couldn't understand, and literally clumping around like peasants in one of these Toulouse-Lautrec or one of these painters, you know. They really were peasants. And there was less association with them than there was with the townspeople in Fresnay. At least I found it so, you know.
Had the battalion started to really get into its motorized role yet, as a part of a motorized division?
At that stage, we travelled on trucks, you know, but we didn't do an awful lot. I just remember at one stage, I'm not quite sure which stage it was, but it was one of these early stages, we had one of these things where we were driven along a road in three-ton trucks and had to de-bus, or disembark, by jumping off the back. And the bus, it was, presumably, it was intended to be dismounting and getting to action under fire, because we had all pile off, about 30 of us pile off the truck, and the truck drove away. It didn't even stop, it just eased down. We leapt off and dived into the cover in the ditch. That was the only sort of practice we had in de-busing and being motorized. We still did our fair whack of route marching. I suppose that was just to keep us occupied and keep us fit, you see. But on this occasion, we did jump off the backs of trucks and so on. And we occasionally saw some of the, I think it was the 4th Northumberland Fusiliers on motorbikes and sidecars, you know. That was about it, you know.
The weapons situation, was it changed in any way?
Not as far as I know. I'd be interested to know whether we had 6 mortars then, but I wasn't interested in mortars, you see, at that stage. But we'd start off with 2, you know. And as I say, we still had the Boy's anti-tank rifle, the Bren gun, and a 2-inch mortar distributed around the platoon and the companies.
And as you moved on from place to place, you still weren't getting any kind of talks which introduced you to the area?
Not really, no, not really.
You were literally dumped in an area?
That's right, there was nothing said about it. You looked at the map, and you knew you were near Amiens, but didn't know much about it.
Where did you move on from Amiens area?
Now, we went in the French coal field in front of Vimy, Alain-les-Marais, Alain in the marshes.
And had your role changed at this point?
Well, no, we were still... You mean our role as infantry or mounted infantry or no, not aware. We were still just 9th Battalion and we moved up there. But it was there where I suppose my more interesting sort of started because we... I was billeted with two old ladies who had a debit at the tobacco post, the post office and the Lashton tobacco shop. And the old ladies, when I went there, taken there by a billeting officer, asked me, did I drink? And I said, yes. And they said, do you get drunk? And I said, no. And there were two mamsels, one was 73, the other one was 70. I gained a certain amount of fame by being able to say to people, oh, I'm living in a house with two mamsels. And when everybody looked like that, I then experienced that one was 70, the other was 73. And I was billeted, when I got friendly with them, I mean, they were very, I was muscular sergeant. About 2 days later, I was sergeant. Then I was Sergeant Jean. Then I was Notre Jean. And our John, and after that. And there were two dear old ladies, God bless them. And I was billeted in a room which had been occupied by German officer in the 1418 war. And that was the same bed, and I had the same wash basin and the wash bowl, you know, the basin wash bowl on the washstand that he'd had. And I think later there were a Saxon regiment. And one of the old ladies, inevitably, and two old ladies, they were both sisters. One was the sort of leader. And she told me how in the 1418 war, the German officers were billeted there and they were always drinking, staggering upstairs and being sick on the stairs and so on. And she called one of them a drunken pig. And she was up in front of the commandant who said, how dare you call an officer of His Imperial German Majesty a drunken pig? Whereupon she said, but it is simple, monsieur. He is a drunken pig. And she got 3 weeks in the local lockup. I said, but mamselle, how terrible. A lady like you, she'd be about 40 at the time. Was nothing, John, she said. My sister used to come and throw bread down through the bars. And all right.
What did they call him? Could we call the name?
Sarrazin. Mademoiselle Sarrazin. S-A-R-R-A-Z-I-N. And... it was a sad comment. They told me, or the older one told me, she remembers as a small child clutching her mother's skirt and her sister being carried as they were retreating in front of the Germans in 1870. They were then occupied during the war, of the 1418 war. She said, in fact, we'd been having a fete and we had flags and banners out when the Germans entered. And the German officer said, how is this? Your country's in danger and you are flying flags and bunting. And they said, just overrun like that. And she was also the one, I'm diverting from dear life stuff, who she said to me, I remember the occasion when the officers were very excited. They brought in some bloodstained equipment, a coat and some things, and they said a very famous English aviator had been shot down in the field outside. And they were very excited. And I went to look, his father put a memorial there. I went to look, it was Captain Ball. And I made inquiries and I found he was buried in Annalan, which was the next village, about a mile or so away, mining village, in the German cemetery. And he was in a central position. And there was an old Frenchman looking after it, who'd looked after it when the Germans were there. And I asked him, how is it that this English aviator is buried in the center of this German? He said, well, monsieur, he was a very famous aviator. And they wished to give him a position of prominence. He was buried right in the centre of the... that's it, by the way. And
what was the battalion billets like in this place, other than your own?
Well, there was a sort of, I suppose, a town hall and so on. The men were billeted in halls and so on, you know, around the mining village, and one or two places like the church hall and that sort of thing, you know. Because there was a Roman Catholic church that had it built in there. And it was also there where I went to Annalan, which was a mining village. You saw the miners walking home black from the pit. And I went to Anala, and we saw an old lady there, and she had a big room, and there were seven of us sergeants went, and she put two big tin baths of hot water there. And we just spun up for who got first bath. We were standing stripped off there, and naked, and the old lady walked in with a tray with glasses on, and I saw these blokes. I said, "Don't say anything. She won't mind. She's used to miners." And I always remember standing there stark naked, and I took my glass of cognac and said, "Salute, madame." And drank it while all seven naked sergeants said, "Votre santé." That's how we arranged our bathing there, because there were no sort of public baths and that sort of thing, you know.
Was the sanitation and hygiene situation all right?
Yes, quite good as far as the folks were concerned. It was also at that stage where we began digging an anti-tank ditch just up on the Belgian frontier, which was one of these follies of the war, because you dug a huge ditch across country, then when you came to a road, the French wouldn't let you dig it. So you walked over the road and dug a ditch, as though the Germans were going to be so obliging as to come through the field.